Good morning and welcome to Real People Talk Autism. I'm Tony Langdon. This week we continue our series of past shows going back to November 2013. We have a number of interesting interviews. I hope you enjoy it, but before we get underway, we'll have a couple of tracks. So sit down, relax and enjoy the show.
Oh, don't you dare look back, just keep your eyes on me. I said you're holding back, she said shut up and dance with me. This woman is my destiny, she said ooh, ooh, shut up and dance with me. We were victims of the night, the chemical, physical, kryptonite. Help us to the base and fade in light.
She said The voice of your community, 106.7 Phoenix FM.
And good morning, everybody. Welcome to Real People Talk Autism. I'm in the studio today. I'm the host, Bec Kelly, and I am in the studio today with our guest co-host, Alison Wallen, who's come back for a second helping. Welcome, Alison.
Hi, guys.
And our co-host extraordinaire, Sarah Hansford, is here in spirit today. She's already sent through emails, so if there's anything that you would like to send through, like Sarah did, you can send that through to us at feedback@phoenixfm.org.au. We're going to be talking a lot about education today, continuing on from last week, and we have a fantastic woman who's going to be on the show all the way from New Zealand, Emma Goodall, and Emma is a woman on the spectrum. She's also an educator. She is an author. She's a public speaker. She's just done everything. She's fantastic. I can't wait to speak with her, and that will be coming up after 10 o'clock. Also, just a little bit of information about the station and the program. You can go to our website, www.phoenixfm.org.au, and there are previous podcasts from earlier shows. Obviously, we have a new podcast link, and I'll get to that in a sec. And you can also listen live. So if you're not in the Bendigo region and you're away on holidays or something, but you don't want to miss the show, you can log on via your phone, via TuneIn app, or via the website and listen live. The listen live tab's up on the right-hand side. Also, you can phone in today. Keep it to when we've got sponsor breaks or audio playing on 0354 44 1129. Also, you can get onto our Facebook page. Our podcaster extraordinaire Tony Langdon gets those podcasts up pretty damn quick after the show's aired. Yeah, he's pretty quick. He's pretty good. And he's probably listening. Hi, Tony, and hi, Mark. I hope everybody's well. And you can get onto our Facebook page. It's www.facebook.com/realpeopletalkautism. And we do have a Twitter, little Twitter feed, which is @ASD Talk Radio. So you can be kept up to date on new podcasts going up or what is coming up on the program. But also with our Facebook page, I really want to hear from everybody. Send us some inboxes on, you know, if you're wanting to be our DJ for the week. DJ Daniel last week was fantastic with his music selection. And, you know, if you've got any kids who want to hear their music being played, please send that through. Anything that you would like to us for us to talk about on the program, any ideas for upcoming programs, you know, this show is for you. So it would be great if you could give us that kind of feedback on what you would like to hear on the show. You'll be kept up to date with some of the links that we talk about on the program, and yeah, you can check all of that out. We spoke a bit about education last week, we spoke a lot about it, and yay to Sarah Hansford for driving a lot of that conversation last week. It was fantastic.
Awesome job, Sarah.
Yay, Sarah. She's just cool. She's so cool. The one thing that we didn't sort of get to in relation to that was she was going to talk about, and I called it spooning, and it was actually bad because
I looked at the title and I went, oh, that's so, got so many connotations.
Yeah, I know, because then the other night I'm looking through like articles on the on Google to get more information about it, and I'm typing in spooning and autism, and all of these filthy sites are coming up, and I'm like, what is this? This isn't what we were going to be talking about, I don't think.
Yeah.
Finally, Sarah put me in the right direction, so thanks, hon. So it's actually called the spoon theory.
Yep.
So we'll go over this because this is a really interesting article. And Sarah, if you're listening, can you please post this article up onto the Real People Talk Autism Facebook page? And it's actually from a WordPress. It's a blog called But You Don't Look Sick. And it's absolutely fascinating. So this is written by a woman by the name of, now, where is Sarah when I need her with names? I'm shocking with names. By a woman by the name of Christine. Let's call her Christine because Miserandino, there it is. As I said, www.butyoudontlooksick.com. And this is an article that she wrote, and I'm going to read it to you, and then we'll have a quick yak about it and see what you think. I nearly called you Sarah then. And see what, you know, what we can sort of decipher from it. My best friend and I were in the diner talking as usual. It was very late and we were eating French fries with gravy. Like normal girls our age, we spend a lot of time in the diner while in college, and most of the time we spent talking about boys, music or trivial things that seemed very important at the time. We never got serious about anything in particular and spent most of our time laughing. As I went to take some of my medicine with a snack, as I usually did, she watched me with an awkward kind of stare instead of continuing the conversation. She then asked me out of the blue what it felt like to have lupus and be sick. I was shocked, not only because she asked the random question, but also because I assumed she knew all there was to know about lupus. She came to doctors with me. She saw me walk with a cane and throw up in the bathroom. She'd seen me cry in pain. What else was there to know? I started to ramble on about pills and aches and pains, but she kept pursuing and didn't seem satisfied with my answers. I was a little surprised, as being my roommate in college and friend for years, I thought she already knew the medical definition of lupus. Then she looked at me with a face every sick person knows well, the face of pure curiosity about something no one healthy can truly understand. She asked what it felt like, not physically, but what it felt like to be me, to be sick. As I tried to gain my composure, I glanced around the table for help or guidance, or at least stall for time to think. I was trying to find the right words. How do I answer a question I never was able to answer for myself? How do I explain every detail of every day being affected and give the emotions a sick person goes through with clarity? I could have given up, cracked a joke like I usually do and changed the subject, but I remember thinking, if I don't try to explain this, how could I ever expect her to understand? If I can't explain this to my best friend, how could I explain my world to anyone else? I had to at least try. At that moment, the spoon theory was born. I quickly grabbed every spoon on the table, how I grabbed spoons off the other tables. I looked at her in the eyes and I said, "Here you go. You have lupus." She looked at me slightly confused, as anyone would when they are being handed a bouquet of spoons. The cold metal spoons clanked in my hands as I grouped them together and shoved them into her hands. I explained that the difference in being sick and being healthy is having to make choices or to consciously think about things when the rest of the world doesn't have to. The healthy have the luxury of the life without choices, a gift most people take for granted. Most people start the day with unlimited amount of possibilities and energy to do whatever they desire, especially young people. For the most part, they do not need to worry about the effects of their actions. So, for my explanation, I use spoons to convey this point. I wanted something for her to actually hold, for me to then take away, since most people who get sick feel a loss of a life they once knew. If I was in control of taking away the spoons, then she would know what it feels like to have someone or something else, in this case lupus, being in control. She grabbed the spoons with excitement. She didn't understand what I was doing, but she is always up for a good time, so I guess she thought I was cracking a joke of some kind, like I usually do when talking about touchy subjects. Little did she know how serious I would become. I asked her to count her spoons. She asked why, and I explained that when you are healthy, you expect to have a never-ending supply of spoons. But when you have to now plan your day, you need to know exactly how many spoons you are starting with. It doesn't guarantee that you might not lose something along the way, but at least it helps to know where you are starting. She counted out 12 spoons. She laughed and said she wanted more. I said no, and I knew right away that this little game would work. When she looked disappointed, and we hadn't even started yet, I've wanted more spoons for years and haven't found a way yet to get more. Why should she? I also told her to always be conscious of how many she had and not to drop them, because she could never forget she had lupus. I asked her to list off the tasks of her day, including the most simple. As she rattled off daily chores or just fun things to do, I explained how each one would cost her a spoon. When she jumped right into getting ready for work as her first task of the morning, I cut her off and took away a spoon. I practically jumped down her throat. I said, no, you don't just get up. You have to crack open your eyes and then realize you are late. You didn't sleep well the night before. You have to crawl out of bed and then you have to make yourself something to eat before you can go and do anything else. Because if you don't, you can't take your medicine. And if you don't take your medicine, you might as well give up all your spoons for today and tomorrow too. I quickly took away a spoon and she realized she hadn't even gotten dressed yet. Showering cost her a spoon, just for washing her hair and shaving her legs. Reaching high and low that early in the morning could actually cost more than one spoon, but I figured I would give her a break. I didn't want to scare her right away. Getting dressed was worth another spoon. I stopped her and broke down every task to show her how every little detail needs to be thought about. You cannot simply just throw clothes on when you are sick. I explained that I have to see what clothes I can physically put on. If my hands hurt that day, buttons are out of the question. If I have bruises that day, I need to wear long sleeves. And if I have a fever, I need a sweater to stay warm and so on. If my hair is falling out, I need to spend more time to look presentable, and then you need to factor in another 5 minutes for feeling badly that it took you 2 hours to do all of this. I think she was starting to understand when she theoretically didn't even get to work and she was left with 6 spoons. I then explained to her that she needed to choose the rest of her day wisely, since when your spoons are gone, they are gone. Sometimes you can borrow against tomorrow's spoon, but just think how hard tomorrow will be with less spoons. I also needed to explain that a person who is sick always lives with the looming thought that tomorrow may be the day that a cold comes, or an infection, or any number of things that could be very dangerous. So you do not know, you do not want to run low on spoons because you never know when you truly will need them. I didn't want to depress her, but I needed to be realistic, and unfortunately being prepared for the worst is part of a real day for me. We went through the rest of the day and she slowly learned that skipping lunch would cost her a spoon, as well as standing on a train or even typing at her computer too long. She was forced to make choices and think about things differently. Hypothetically, she had to choose not to run errands so that she could eat dinner that night. When we got to the end of her pretend day, she said she was hungry. I summarized that she had to eat dinner, but she only had one spoon left. If she cooked, she wouldn't have enough energy to clean the pots. If she went out for dinner, she might be too tired to drive home safely. Then I also explained that I didn't even bother to add into this game that she was also nauseous, that cooking was probably out of the question anyway, so she decided to make soup. It was easy. I then said it was only 7 p.m, you have the rest of the night, but maybe end up with one spoon so you can do something fun or clean your apartment or do chores, but you can't do it all. I rarely see her emotional, so when I saw her upset, I knew maybe I was getting through to her. I didn't want my friend to be upset, but at the same time, I was happy to think finally maybe someone understood me a little bit. She had tears in her eyes and asked quietly, "Christine, how do you do it? Do you really do this every day?" I explained that some days were worse than others. Some days I have more spoons than most, but I could never make it go away and I can't forget about it. I always have to think about it. I handed her a spoon I had been holding in reserve and I said simply, "I have learned to live life with an extra spoon in my pocket in reserve. You need to always be prepared." It's hard. The hardest thing I've ever had to learn is to slow down and not to do everything. I fight this every day. I hate feeling left out, having to choose to stay home or to not get things done that I want to. I wanted her to feel that the frustration. I wanted her to understand that everything everyone else does comes so easy, but for me, it is 100 little jobs in one day. I need to think about the weather, my temperature that day, and the whole day's plans before I can attack anyone. One given thing. When other people can simply do things, I have to attack it and make a plan like I am strategizing a war. It is it is in that lifestyle, the difference between being sick and healthy. It is the beautiful ability to not think and just do. I miss that freedom. I miss never having to count spoons. After we were emotional and talked about this for a little while longer, I sensed she was sad. Maybe she finally understood. Maybe she realised that she could never truly and honestly say she understands, but at least now she might not complain so much when I can't go out for dinner some nights, or when I never seem to make it to her house and she always has to drive to mine. I gave her a hug when we walked out of the diner. I had the one spoon in my hand and I said, "Don't worry, I see this as a blessing. I've been forced to think about everything I do. You know how many spoons people waste every day? I don't have room for wasted time or wasted spoons, and I chose to spend this time with you." Ever since this night, I've used the spoon theory to explain my life to many people. In fact, my family and friends refer to spoons all the time. It has been a code word for what I can and cannot do. Once people understand the spoon theory, they seem to understand me better. But I think they live their life a little differently too. I think it isn't just good for understanding lupus, but anyone dealing with any disability or illness. Hopefully they don't take so much for granted or their life in general. I give a piece of myself in every sense of the word when I do anything. It has become an inside joke. I have become famous for saying to people jokingly that they should feel really special when I spend time with them because they have one of my spoons. What do you think?
I'm still trying not to cry. I cry every single time I read that.
Yeah, I know. It's very emotional, and obviously, you know, it is about lupus. It's not about autism.
But she did say,
as
that,
she said,
yeah,
if you put it in the context of you know, the autism spectrum, you know, like I have friends who now finally get it when I say, I can't be at this wedding. I can't do this. I can't do that. It's not because I don't want to.
Yeah.
It's just my life has a series of spoons in it every day, and if I give that spoon away to that, then I'm taking one spoon away from my children.
Yeah.
That's the way that I see it.
That's the same way I see it.
Yeah, yeah. Awesome. Okay. That's okay. I was just checking out to see whether or not I've missed news and weather at 10 o'clock, but that's okay. I was going to do news and weather at 10 this morning, but that's okay. We're good. I'll do it at 11. So we'll talk a little bit more about this. So, you know, I guess being on the spectrum, you know, do you constantly, obviously I'm going to ask you the question,
yeah,
do you constantly have people asking you, what's it like to be autistic?
And no, I don't. I generally just shove it down their face.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. You are because, big on disclosure, aren't you?
Because I want them to get me and I want to be included, but they need to know that it has to be on, I guess, my terms, because I don't always get it. I don't. And to constantly be thinking, how am I going to interact today, was getting too much, because I had the two kids at home who had the extra needs as well.
Mm-hmm.
And my brain was going constantly to them. So how do I explain this? I needed to take a step back and I needed to be able to stop thinking, okay, I want to interact with these people and I want to do it on their terms.
Yeah.
Once I got the diagnosis, it was like, okay, I now have something that can can help me get people to interact with me on my terms.
Mm-hmm.
If I can get them to understand even just a little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
This is like,
you know, we were having a conversation about parents and things like that, and
yeah.
You know, I'm still trying to get people in my family to understand about our life and what is going on in our life.
Yeah.
And if I use this theory with the spoons,
yep,
I think it would actually, you know, explain it a lot better. Give them 12 spoons, or, you know, if I go through my day, because our day has to be pretty much planned out, you know, if there is something in that day that is going to change, that's different, we need to prepare for that days, sometimes weeks beforehand. Because if I throw something new into the mix for my kids, it's not so much then and there when things sort of we go a bit haywire in our house. It's sort of maybe a couple of hours later. That's when, or the next day, we have not trouble, but just, you know, the less anxiety that I put on my children, the better.
Yeah, well, I deal with it a bit differently.
Yeah.
I tend to not get, my weeks aren't set in stone. Mm-hmm. So if something changes, I have to make the kids accept that this is going to happen, but what I said was going to happen is going to happen, but it's going to happen later.
Mm-hmm.
And over time, they've gotten used to that.
Yeah.
So I guess I've gotten them to understand that they can trust me.
Yeah.
So a lot of back work has gone on getting my kids to the stage where they know that if I say this is going to happen, this is going to happen. Now, someone comes along and tries to make me not be able to make that happen, then they generally get me backing off from them.
Yeah.
Because I know full well that I promised my kids that this is going to happen, and no way in hell am I going to let that happen, because I promised. And yeah, once I promised, or I've said, then that's set in stone.
Yeah.
Because my brain goes, no, you can't. Because my mum would say stuff and then it would never happen, and I was like,
yeah.
Because I didn't understand that saying, yeah, this is going to happen,
and then it doesn't
happen, was the way that it worked.
Well, I mean, I was talking to Sarah about this yesterday because
I don't know if I'm coming across.
No,
right.
You are, Dawn. You are. Don't worry. It's completely clear. And this happened the other day. We were outside, not yesterday, the day before, in the afternoon, and a little baby sparrow had fallen, because I saw Audrey chasing after this thing that was jumping in the backyard, and yep. I'm like, don't tell me we've got frogs. We haven't had any rain. What's going on? And it turned out it was actually a little baby sparrow who was trying to learn how to fly, and its mother and father, mummy and daddy sparrow, were up on the fence line watching, obviously, very interested. Hopefully my child wasn't going to hurt this little bit. Well, obviously she wasn't.
Mm.
And I caught it and I said, look, honey, its mummy and daddy are up there watching. They want to teach it how to fly, you know, and I could see the anxiety rising because she wanted to keep it. and I said, well, look, you go off and have a shower, and if it's still out here when you get out of the shower, then we'll put it in a box and we'll take it somewhere where it needs to go, where it can be looked after. So she's in the shower and we popped it up over the fence on a ledge where, yep, it would be safe, where the parents could get to it. And sure enough, the parents got to it and flew it away.
Mm.
And she got out of the shower and it was gone. Aww. And I know. And it was just 2 hours of screaming. And finally I said, you know what, we'll go to the pet shop tomorrow and we will look at buying a budgerigar. Oh. We will look at getting a new bird. Well, of course, all she heard was, I'm getting a new bird.
Yeah.
And the next morning, thinking, oh, well, I forgot all about it.
Oh, dear.
And she opens her eyes and the first thing out of her mouth is, bird, are we going to buy a bird today?
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, I just have to be really careful what I say to these kids because they're going to hold me to it. And she did. We had to take her to the pet shop. You know, we had a speech and language assessment in the morning, and then all the way through it she kept saying, when are we going to the pet shop? When are we going to the pet shop?
Yeah.
And so we got to the pet shop and luckily there were no budgies there. Thank goodness. And I said, well, look, you know, the ladies actually told me that there's a 10-day waiting period. You've got to wait 10 days. And I thought, well, this will give her time to think about it and think about whether a bird is what she really wants or if it's just because she's just had that experience in our backyard. She doesn't realise you're not going to be able to touch it. You can't get it out of the cage because it'll fly away. And that gives us time to talk to her about those sorts of things and read books and stuff. So, yeah, that was my experience of telling her something. And then the next day she was like straight on it, bang, you have to do this. You said you were going to do it. So, and you have to have follow through. So be careful what you tell your children, people who are listening, because they will remember and they will expect follow through. So if it's something you're not expecting to follow through, do not tell them that. You know, it's easier, I guess, to deal with the, you know, the tantrum or the meltdown on the day when you say, I don't think that that's a good idea, as opposed to saying yes, and then the next day when they actually want you to do it, and you say, no, it's not going to happen, or I don't think it's a good idea. It just messes them all around a bit. Now, I think we're going to go off to a little bit of a music break, because I have, I tell you what, Sarah and I are pretty lucky. We got sent a really nice little pack this week from the band Rudely Interrupted. Now, if you don't know who this band is, I suggest you go onto Google or go onto YouTube and type in Rudely Interrupted. This band is awesome. Every single member of this band has a disability, and their music is, they're selling out shows all around the world. They're from Melbourne, and you can actually buy their CDs and T-shirts and things like that on their website, www.rudelyinterrupted.com. I'm going to flog the crap out of their music today, because they've sent me 3 CDs, which are just fantastic, and one of them's actually one of their songs that they have sung in Chinese for when they were in China, and they did shows over in China. But this is off their Tragedy of Commons CD, and it's called Get Me Out of Here. So check out them.
Sounds relatable.
That's all right. And when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about school refusal. And also, I have some audio from, if Sarah was here, she'd be rolling her eyes when I say this, and I can almost see her rolling her eyes at home, from Dr. Temple Grandin. Yeah, there you go. Everyone's laughing. Yeah, I can hear Sarah laughing from here.
You're obsessed, girl.
This is, I know. I just love her. This is the world, and I think I actually have played a shorter version of this, and it's called The World Needs All Different Types of Brains, and it's mainly the Q&A session at the end, which is fantastic. Her presentation goes for about 12 minutes, but then there's like a 10-minute Q&A session at the end, which is just brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant.
Why wouldn't you? She's fantastic.
I know. And then we'll be coming up after 10:30 is we'll be speaking with Emma Goodall in regards to education inclusion, you know, and a neurodiverse approach to education. Teaching with passions and skill, as opposed to things that the individual are not good at. So anyway, so this is Rudely Interrupted. Get Me Out of Here. That's called, and we'll be back soon.
I love the title.
I know. We'll be back soon.
Tell me this is real. So tell me this is real. Say it isn't so. Won't you say it isn't so? Do I know all I need to know? I scream and shout. I scream and shout. I scream and shout. Get me out of here. So get me out of here. The space I really fear. It's the space I really fear. Do I know all I need to know?
shout, I scream and shout. I scream and shout, I scream and shout. I scream and shout, I scream and shout. Phoenix FM.
And we're back. I hope you enjoyed that. That was rudely interrupted with Get Me Out of Here. So they're pretty cool guys. Did you know the lead singer, Allison, of the band, he was actually born with no eyes, and he has Asperger's. Yeah. And part of his Asperger's, he has perfect pitch. So he can hear something and sing it back perfectly. A great band, absolutely great band. So, guys, if you don't know who these fellas are, and there is a female in the band too, their tambourine player, she's just fantastic. She has Down syndrome and she's just fantastic. They are on YouTube. They have a YouTube channel. They're also, as I said, www.rudelyinterrupted.com. We'll play some more tracks after everything, after we talk about stuff and stuff like that and things. Anyway, so now you obviously, do you have kids in at school, or they're about to start next year?
I have one in high school. He's neurotypical.
Yep.
That we know of.
Uh-huh.
Well, no, there's really no doubt that he is neurotypical. It's just that he does have a few traits, but, I don't really like saying this, but because it's disrespectful of the people on the spectrum, but, yeah, he does have some interesting little qualities about him, poor memory.
Oh, okay.
That is poor memory with what he chooses to have poor memory.
Oh,
with.
Does he?
I don't know if it's a choice or whether it's just something that happens, but it's not with everything. It's interesting. Let's just put it that way. I don't know whether it's interesting because he doesn't have a brain like me or because in some ways he does. But yeah, he's not. The other two, one's about to start school.
Mm-hmm.
And one's about to start for kinder.
Yeah.
Not pre-kinder, but kinder. Yeah, so.
So you wouldn't have encountered school refusal as yet?
No.
Not yet.
No.
It's not something. Well, I do see a lot of posts go up, and obviously I'm not one to sort of wish Sarah was here to discuss it, but a lot of families who have kids on the spectrum experience what's called school refusal.
Which is the child refusing or the school refusing?
The child refusing to go to school, either an incident.
I did that with my mum a lot.
Did you?
Yeah.
So you just, what made you feel like you just didn't want to go to school, or it was just the environment?
Grade 3 and 4, my teacher just was not great, so I had nightmares, and I would wake up thinking the nightmares were real.
Yeah.
So I didn't want to go to school and face the monster.
Yeah. And this can happen with a lot of kids too. You know, they believe those monsters are real, and I guess some, and for them it is real. You know, that anxiety. I mean, we're not having school refusal with Audrey. We were just having really bad transitions.
Yeah.
She had two negative experiences on her transition days,
mm-hmm.
Of entering in the classroom through the front door,
yep.
and walking into a classroom full of children.
Yeah, well, that would be really confronting.
Different noises, different sounds, different environment. It was very,
and it's
very
instant. You go from being behind the wall to being in the noise. It's like bam.
Yeah. Yeah, well, she could hear all of it because she's got super sensitive hearing, you know.
Yeah, I used to have that, but now that I think I'm going deaf. It's a blessing in disguise. Not.
Yeah, well, I know I'm going deaf, but anyway, we'll talk about that another day. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether it's selective hearing or what. But anyway, what we found, though, was 20 metres before she even hit the classroom.
It was enough.
She just went, I want to go home.
Mm.
We hadn't even gone in that classroom and she wanted to go home.
Yeah.
And so we tried a different approach this week. We actually went through a different door and we made sure she went into an empty classroom with just her teachers and we'd set out, I'd spoken to the teachers previously and we set out like dinosaurs and ponies and things, the things that she's passionate about. And for half an hour she sat down on the floor with her teacher and, you know, and I call that a successful transition. And as I said to them, when she wants to finish, we finish. We will do everything on her terms for the next couple of weeks. And then after that we'll do the same thing next week. And then the week after that we might slowly have kids come into the room, not all of them, just a couple. And then the week after that, add a couple more in, but let's not get her into a room that's full of kids. Let the kids come into the room while she's there.
Well, I try to get Lydia to kinder before everybody else arrives, so she can be in the room where there's, she's about fourth or fifth every week when I take her, mainly because I want the noise to come around her rather than being bombarded.
Going straight into it,
It's a lot smoother if we do that with our church too, because our church is one of the bigger ones. So getting there earlier is often better than getting there later. But we also have this little thing that she does herself. She grabs a picture, a drawing set, which they have by the doors for the kids to grab on their way in. The minute she's got that in her hand, she's relaxed as well, and I can sense it. So yeah, as long as they're got, as long as she's got that, she's fine. But yeah, we're getting a lot of refusing to stay in the kid program. Yeah, at the moment.
That's like the holiday program thing.
It's like Sunday school.
Okay,
We're getting that with her at the moment.
Yeah. And you know, for in my instance, it was about creating a different experience because she'd had those two negative experiences. I didn't want her going into school thinking,
I'm going to hate this.
I'm going to hate it from the get-go before we'd even started. So it was important that we created a fun, you know, and she's now saying she can't wait to go back next week.
Well,
so we'll go through the same back door, not through the front, and see how we go there. Well, Tony Atwood, Dr. Tony Atwood, Professor Tony Atwood, Tony to some people, actually has a really great article in regards to school refusal, but it's mainly about homework. Some kids are finding it extremely hard with school when they're given homework and as a result of refusing to go to school. I don't know if anybody has ever experience this, but I do know there are a lot of families out there who are struggling with school refusal at the moment. And what this article pretty much states is a major cause of anguish for children with an autistic spectrum disorder. Their families and teachers is the satisfactory completion of homework. Why should this group of children have such an emotional reaction to the mere thought of having to start their homework and such difficulty completing assigned tasks? There may be two explanations. The first is based on their degrees of stress and mental exhaustion during the day at school, and the second is due to their profile of cognitive skills. Now, this you've got to remember, this is Tony's view on things. There may or may not be things in this article that people agree with, or there may be things that people go, Tony, all the way. But this article actually covers a whole range of things. Now, obviously, the article is called Should Children with Autism Spectrum Disorders Be Exempt from Doing Homework? The second part of the article reads about the stress of being at school for a child with autism. As with their classroom peers, a child with an autistic spectrum disorder has to learn the traditional education curriculum, but they encounter additional learning experiences and sources of stress than do other children in their class. They have an additional curriculum named the social curriculum. They have to use their intellectual reasoning to determine the social rules of the classroom and the playground. Other children do not have to consciously learn social integration skills, but these children have to decipher the social cues and codes and cognitively determine what to do and say in social situations. Often, their primary feedback is criticism for an error with little recognition from those when they make the correct response. You're laughing.
Yeah.
Learning only from your mistakes is not the most efficient way to learn. Thus, these children make the correct response. Oh, sorry, I've just read the same line twice. Thus, these children have to concentrate on an extra curriculum that leaves them intellectually and emotionally exhausted at the end of the school day. They also have difficulty reading and responding to the emotional signals of the teacher and other children, coping with the complex socialisation, noise and chaos from the playground. The unexpected changes in the school routine and the intense sensory experiences of a noisy classroom. Throughout the school day, they rarely have an opportunity to relax. It is essential that we recognise the degree of stress experienced by such children, as the signs can become evident in their behaviour and mood. The signs include the child who is described as Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, in that the indicators of stress are not conspicuous at school, but the child is a very different character at home. They may be quiet and compliant in the classroom, but intolerant and aggressive immediately when they return home. Some children become extremely anxious in the morning before going to school, and school refusal or walking out of school can be a sign of unbearable stress. Other children can express the signs at school by episodes of extreme anxiety or anger, with incidents of panic and disruptive and explosive behaviour. Others suffer chronic stress, which contributes to a clinical depression. This is Tony talking. When I talk to children with autism and Asperger's syndrome who are having difficulty learning the social curriculum and coping with the stress of school, they often explain that they want a clear division between home and school. Their comment is, school is for learning, home is for fun or relaxation. Thus, the prospect of interrupting their much-needed and deserved fun and relaxation with homework is more than they can cope with. Do you agree with that?
I would agree that most people on the spectrum want that, but I did not. I saw learning as the most important thing there was, whether it was learning at school or whether it was learning at home.
Yeah.
I just wanted to learn because learning meant that I would get out of where I was.
Yeah.
In get out of where I was, I meant get out of everything of where I was.
So, but when you talk about, like, learning at school and learning at home, was that something that you created for yourself, or was that an environment that your parents introduced for you that you followed and thus became routine?
My parents didn't know that I was different. In fact, my mum fought my school tooth and nail when they even suggested that I had differences, because as far as mum was concerned, I was just sensitive, which I would agree to. I was very sensitive. But yeah, my mum had the added thing of being a sensitive child herself.
Mm-hmm.
Whether that equals Asperger's or autism or not, I'll never know because she's no longer with us. But what was the question?
do you believe that that, you know, your environment when it came to enjoying education at school, it was you.
Yeah,
you created that routine for yourself.
My mum was not very educated minded. She was more, you have to go to school because you have to go to school. My dad was not a big influence because he was not at home. He was always at work.
Yeah.
So if I don't know if it was me or whether it was the extended family on my dad's side, but I've always had the drive to learn.
Yeah.
I've always wanted to learn. And that's the one thing I contribute to being the best thing about having Asperger's, is I want to learn and I want to know everything.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he's done a profile on this page too, of cognitive skills of children with an autism spectrum disorder They have an unusual profile of cognitive skills that must be recognised and accommodated when they are undertaking academic work at school and home. One aspect of the profile is impaired executive functioning.
I agree with that.
Mm-hmm. The profile is similar to that of children with attention deficit disorder in that they can have difficulty planning, organising and prioritising, a tendency to be impulsive and inflexible when problem solving and poor working memory. Other features Yep. include a difficulty generating new ideas, a need for supervision and guidance and determining what is relevant and redundant, as well as poor time perception and time management. There is also the likelihood of an unusual profile on standardised tests of Yep. intelligence, especially with regard to verbal and visual or performance scale intelligence.
Yep.
Some children are verbalisers and have a relative strength in reading vocabulary and verbal concepts, while others are visualisers and a picture is worth a thousand words.
Oh, yeah.
The child's cognitive and learning profile is usually recognised by school authorities and special provision made for the child in terms of an assistant in the classroom to facilitate their academic progress. The teacher knows how to adapt the curriculum for a child with an autism spectrum disorder, but this knowledge and service are not usually available at home. And then he goes on, the following range of strategies are designed to minimise the impaired executive function, accommodate their profile of cognitive skills and help the child complete their homework assignments with less stress for the child and family. So, create a learning environment. The area where the child works must be conducive to concentration and learning. A useful model is the child's classroom with appropriate seating, lighting and removal of any distractions. The distractions can be visual, such as the presence of toys or television, which
posters, artwork,
which are a constant reminder of what the child would rather be doing, or auditory distractions such as the noise from electrical appliances and the chatter of siblings. Ensure the working surface only has equipment relevant to the tasks. Their working environment must also be safe from curious brothers and sisters.
Mm-hmm.
A daily homework timetable can be made by a parent with guidance from the teacher to define the expected duration and content of each homework activity or assignment. This can be extremely helpful if there are problems with the child's allocation of time to each homework component. Sometimes the homework can take hours when the teacher intended only several minutes on a specified task. A timer can be used to remind the child how much time is remaining to complete each section of homework. It is also important to ensure that time scheduled for homework does not coincide with the child's favourite television program. If it does, they may have priority use of the video recorder and can watch the program after their homework. If regular breaks are necessary to promote concentration, the work can be divided into segments to indicate how much work the child has to complete before they take a momentary break. The usual mistake is to expect too much prolonged concentration. The teacher's preparation of the homework. The teacher can highlight key aspects of the homework sheet, written material and questions so that the child knows which aspects are relevant to their preparation of the assignment. They can ask the child to formulate their plan before commencing the assignments to ensure their work is coherent and logical, especially if the homework is an essay. If the assignment takes several days to complete, it is important that the teacher regularly reviews the child's rough drafts and progress, which also increases the likelihood that it will be completed on time. Yeah?
Mm. They're good ideas.
Well, you know, Tony. Memory problems. If the child has difficulty remembering exactly what was set for homework and remembering relevant information during homework, a characteristic of impaired executive function, a solution is to buy an executive toy. A small cassette recorder used for dictation can provide a record of the teacher's spoken instructions, and the child can add his or her own comments or personal memo to the recording to remind them of key information. The child and their parent will then know exactly what was said and what is relevant to the task. Another strategy is to have the telephone number of another child in the class to ask them for the relevant information. A homework diary and planner can help the child remember which books to take home and the specific homework for each evening. An executive diary or file of facts from the stationery store may make this strategy more appealing to the child. The techniques are explained as being appropriate for adult executives rather than for children with learning problems. Supervision. The child may have difficulty getting started or knowing what to do first. Procrastination can be an issue and a parent may have to supervise the start of the homework. Once the child has started, this is not the end of the supervision. A parent will also need to be available if the child requires assistance when they are confused to ensure that they have chosen the appropriate strategy. There can be a tendency for such children to have a closed mind to alternative strategies and a determination to pursue an approach when other children would have recognised the signs that it would be wise to consider another approach. A technique to show that there is more than one line of thought is to provide the child with a list of alternative strategies to solve the particular problem. The child may need to know there is a plan B. Parents and teachers soon become aware of the degree of supervision required, which can be a major problem for a parent with other family commitments when the child is doing their homework. Supervision is also necessary to help the child prioritise, plan, assist with word retrieval problems, and maintain motivation. Motivation can be enhanced by specific rewards for concentration and effort. Emotion management. Children with an autism spectrum disorder are notorious for their difficulty coping with frustration and criticism and their inability to manage their emotions. They can become quite agitated when confused or having made a mistake. An adult will need... An adult will need to be available to help the child remain calm and logical. The adult will also need to model calmness, which can be difficult when both child and adult are confused as to what to do. It can end in tears for both parties. are you laughing because...
That's just me.
Do you think that would be a hard issue for a parent who has a diagnosis of autism for themselves to be able to manage that sort of thing for their child as well? Or, you know, do you think because you're sort of thinking in the same way that the child does that you would actually be able to create something that you know is going to work for them?
It depends on the individual with the autism. I mean, I'm very in tune with my kids most of the time, except for when I'm highly stressed or overtired or, well, at least I hope that's the case, Anthony. you can tell me when I get home if I'm completely wrong. It depends on the person with the autism. If they're only able to just do one thing, then it depends on what they choose. Like if they can only do work, then they'll probably have difficulty with it. If they choose to only look after the kids, they'll be fine.
Yeah.
If they're able to do more than one thing, like have a job, come home, do kids, prepare tea, fantastic. I'm not wired that way. I choose the kids. Because that's where I'm needed the most. But, yeah, I think it depends on the individual and themselves. Some yes, some no.
Well, he goes on to talk about also cognitive style.
Yeah.
Okay. Special consideration should be given to the child's cognitive strengths and weaknesses. If the child's relative strength is in visual reasoning, then flow diagrams, mind maps and demonstrations will enhance their understanding.
Yep.
If their strength is in verbal skills, then written instructions and discussion using metaphors, especially metaphors associated with their special interests, will help.
Mm.
Additional strategies include the use of a computer and keyboard, especially for those children who have problems with handwriting. Sometimes a parent acts as an executive secretary and types the material for the child and proofreads their answers. Homework may be a collaborative rather than solitary activity. The parent is not being overprotective or neurotic. They just know that without their involvement, the work would not be done. children with autism often enjoy having access to a computer and may be more able to understand material if it is presented on a computer screen. Material presented by a person adds a social and linguistic dimension to the situation, which can increase the child's confusion. Teachers should consider adapting the homework so that the considerable proportion of the work is conducted using a computer. Word processing facilities, especially graphics and grammar and spell check programs, are invaluable to improving the legibility and quality of the finished product. If the parent is unable to help the child solve a particular problem, a solution is to come to an arrangement with the teacher whereby the teacher is contacted by telephone without hesitation as to the time of day or night and they can talk directly to the child. Regular use of this approach can lead to a significant reduction in the type and amount of homework. Children with autism require special consideration when learning new material. Homework should primarily be designed to consolidate and practice known information rather than introducing new concepts. Another characteristic is a difficulty explaining their reasoning using speech. The child may provide the correct solution to a mathematical problem but not be able to use words to explain how they achieve the answer. Their cognitive strategies may be unconventional and intuitive rather than deductive. One may need to accept their correct solution even if the logic is unclear to the neurotypical mind. One problem with this characteristic is that it may be difficult for the parent to correct the alternative reasoning when the child has a mental block. Teaching a child with autism requires special skill, and a parent is not expected to have those skills. As a parent, one is also more emotionally involved than a class teacher, and it can be difficult for them to be objective and emotionally detached. One option is to hire a homework tutor to provide the skill guidance and supervision. However, this may be beyond the financial resources of most families.
Thank you for saying that bit.
And there is a controversial suggestion.
Oh, really? Okay.
Here it is. If homework is associated with such anguish, what can be done to reduce the despair of the child who is exhausted from their day at school? The parent who tries to motivate their child and the teacher who recognises that homework is not the most effective means of education for such children. If the regular amount of homework is demanded of the child, then everyone must recognise the considerable degree of time and commitment that is necessary from all parties to ensure it is completely satisfactorily and satisfactorily and on time. One option is to enable the child to complete their homework at school. It can be undertaken at lunchtime and before or after classes in their home class or in the school library. However, they would still require supervision and guidance from a teacher or assistant. In high school, some children have been able to graduate after taking fewer subjects and the extra time available in the school day dedicated to homework. If all these strategies are unsuccessful, what is the alternative? Should children with autism be exempt from doing homework? If the strategies outlined in this article are unsuccessful or unable to be implemented, then my reply is yes. Sometimes this advice is to the great relief of the child, their parent, and probably their teacher. And you can quote Tony Atwood on this. This paper that I just read was originally published in the summer of 2000, so this is going back 13 years, in the Morning News. So, a lot of what he's saying is still relevant here. Obviously, it's obviously getting the teachers on board as well with it. That's the hard bit, in my eyes anyway. That's the one that I find hard.
I didn't have the problem getting my teachers on board. In year 11, I had the full curriculum of set amount of subjects. I was sick for a good month with something, and my teacher was on long service leave. I came back at the beginning of term two. The teacher that was on leave came back, and I went up to him and I said, look, I miss this much. And he went, Ali, I know you well enough to know that this is going to be too much of a stress for you. And I'm catching up with everybody else as well.
Yeah.
So this is my suggestion. Why don't you dump methods, because it was maths methods, and just focus on your other subjects? That way you'll have more time to do better in those. You'll be less anxious,
mm-hmm.
and we just avoid all this catching up after school, which is going to be taxing on both of us, especially you.
Mm.
And you use the subject time to do your other work so that when you go home, you can go home. You can take your dog for a walk. You can go for a bike ride. You can do whatever you need to do to unwind and then have tea, watch your shows, do whatever's left over of homework, go to bed, come back.
Yeah. Tony's just sent through another email in regards to homework for him, and he's written, homework was always an issue for me and still can be, and a lot of it came to burnout.
Yeah.
I need my time in the evenings, whether that be to be at home quietly or doing something that balances out the stresses of the day. By homework, I'm including both set tasks or assignments, as well as general after-hour study. I never had issues with not wanting to go to school. I love school and learning, though usually hit the wall after the first 6 weeks because of homework and study loads. And he also likes to keep his environment separate. I have to separate home life from study or work, usually by location, though when I was working from home, I was able to achieve separation by time of day. That extends to leisure time, where I find having to go out for activities such as gym works much better than trying to do the same exercises at home.
Mm.
So thanks, Tony. You're a champion.
106.7 Phoenix FM.
I said this.
106.7 Phoenix FM.
And we're back. And Emma, if you're listening to the show, we're trying to get in touch with you madly and can't. I'm having trouble with the number here. So if there's any way that you can get in touch with us, the number here is 03544 1129. I am really sorry for that, guys, because I was really looking forward to speaking with her, and hopefully between now and 11:30 we'll be able to get Emma on the line, because I have some humdinger questions here to ask her. So hopefully we can make this happen. Okay, so we will continue on now. Where am I? See, now I'm all out of whack. What am I going to do? Well, obviously, going back to the whole homework thing, and yeah. I mean, obviously, I was going to talk about school refusal, but see, that can be a huge factor when it comes to school refusal and stuff. You know, if there's too much pressure coming from homework and all these other outside factors, you're definitely going to get a kid that's going, no, so not going.
The days where I hadn't completed my homework were the worst anxiety-wise, because I felt like I'd let myself down and my teacher down, my parents down. It was just dreadful. I'd done everything I could, and I spent hours on it, knowing full well that one of my friends would have only spent about half an hour on it, deciphering words, deciphering what they meant, deciphering everything I possibly could just to get it done, and I still didn't manage to get it done.
Yeah.
And it's not because I was silly or dumb, which was what I told myself at the time. It was because it wasn't written in a way or presented in a way that was helpful for me.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the task was then longer for me than what it was planned to be.
Mm-hmm.
So I was wasting time on this one, which often meant that I didn't get another one done.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to choose. And often the one which I understood more was the one that won out, even if it was on a less interesting topic.
Yeah.
Because I had to use my time effectively. I couldn't waste time on ones that I wanted to do just because I wanted to do them.
Yeah.
If I didn't understand what I wanted to do.
Yeah. Well,
what I was to do.
Look, I mean, the posts that I read, and you read them too, you know, we go on to Facebook and you know, like on a majority of the autism pages, it's about, you know, education, how the system's failing kids and how the teachers are not understanding, and I guess it's up to the teachers too, as well as the parents, to provide their strategies so that our kids are going to enjoy school, I guess, you know, because we want school to be an enjoyable experience for our kids, because we want them to get the best possible, you know, start in life when it comes to, you know, once they finish school, then they have to do a whole new transition into the employment and the workforce side of things. And, you know, then we have a whole different set of other rules going on there. But, hang on a moment. I'm getting emails through. I'm getting emails from Sarah now. Lots and lots of emails from Sarah. Teachers would be very smart in taking into consideration the spoon theory when it comes to homework.
Yes.
Yay, Sarah. See, explaining routine and control would be helpful for some parents too. As parents, we are told that routine is crucial, but how effective is it to just enforce a routine?
Life doesn't run by routines. It can, but it doesn't. Not normally, not naturally anyway.
Now, hang on a minute. She's just, I love Sarah doing work. She's doing work here. We've got a few minutes before I have to go off to news and weather. So, Emma, if you are listening to the show, Emma, we have been trying to get in contact with you and we can't. So our number here is 03544 1129. I know there's a lot of people who are wanting to hear from you, including myself. I was so excited. I was actually really nervous about talking to her today. But look, guys, if for some reason this doesn't happen, I promise you, once I get off air today, I will get home and I will get in contact with her and do another interview for next week. I'll pre-record something and we will have a nice big interview for you next week. Sarah's just sent me through an article from the Thinking Person's Guide to Autism, and it's a bit big to read now. I can get to it after. And says, if you're listening, post this one up onto the, our Facebook page as well. It's called Why Autistic Students Need Autistic Role Models. And it's actually written, it was actually an article that was spoken about by with a psychologist, Cynthia Arnold, and autistic self-advocate Carla Fisher. I love Carla. I think she has a lot of very interesting things to say, and obviously from her perspective in regards to students, she's very passionate about this. She has put a lot of posts up on her Facebook page, which is the Carla's ASD page. And she has a lot of very interesting things to say in regards to that. And I'll get to this article a little bit after news and weather, because that's coming up really, really soon, like in a couple of minutes, and I can't miss it, because, you know, everyone likes to hear the news and the weather. So we have to interrupt autism for what's going on in the world out there. Yeah. And you're heading off. You're leaving us at 11.
Yes.
So we'll I really appreciate you coming in. Lots of really fantastic insight from you today, Alison. And I really appreciate that, because it takes a lot to take your time out on a Saturday, get yourself up nice and early.
Oh, I would have been up early anyway. Yeah. It's only because my son had a bye in cricket that I could come. So yeah.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate you coming out and hanging out with us and chatting.
My pleasure.
No, I really love it, and we love having you here. So please, you know,
I'll come whenever I can.
I know. Well, that would be awesome. That would be super awesome. You know, we love that. Where are we? I might play another track from Rudely Interrupted. I did play a track before called No Goodbyes. And this was actually off their Mystery Girl CD. As I said, you can actually get copies of Rudely Interrupted CDs, as well as other little fun little goodies off their website, www.rudelyinterrupted.com. And they are super awesome. I'm going to play another track off the Mystery Girl CD, and this is called Is This Me? So enjoy this. And that was Rudely Interrupted. I decided to play an additional track there because, you know, I'm just that way inclined. And guess what? We have Emma Goodall on the line all the way from New Zealand. This is fantastic. Thank you to Brendan O'Brien for making this happen. Just a bit of information about Emma. She is an autism consultant and special needs teacher and advisor who has Asperger's. Her PhD research factors involved in teaching students on the autistic spectrum and how teachers feel about teaching these students. Realising how different autistic and non-autistic thinking is, Emma is passionate about enabling families and educators to understand these differences and work with autism spectrum children and adults in a positive way. She's also authored a book called Understanding and Facilitating the Achievement of Autistic Potential. Welcome to the show, Emma. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much for asking me to come on air. I'm very excited.
Oh, look, I've been wanting this to happen for a very long time, and when we couldn't get through to you, I'm like, oh no. So I'm really happy to have you here, and obviously I have lots of questions to ask you, and my co-host Sarah, who's on the autism spectrum herself, has actually written some too because she's a huge fan of your book, and I know Tony Langdon is a huge fan of yours as well. So this is just feeling the love right now. All right. So the first question I'd like to ask you is, how did you come to know that you had Asperger's?
It's quite funny, really, because part of my PhD research, I went to the APAC in 2011,
mm-hmm.
and always just thought I was a little bit odd, a little bit different, the nerd in the back of the class, and I heard Tony Atwood talk about females on the spectrum, and I had been doing a lot of work with spectrum kids and thought, well, you know, they're a bit like I am, but not quite. And he did the list, and I ticked all the list, and I phoned up my partner back in New Zealand, and I said, I think I might have Asperger's. And she works in psychiatry, and she said, yeah, did you not know?
So did you have to go...
The place.
Sorry?
And then everything fell into place. So last year I got a formal diagnosis done in Melbourne, just so that I could... that Aspie thing of we've got to have everything ticked and everything written down and everything ordered. So, yeah.
So, was that a hard thing to get, like being an adult on the spectrum for you? Because I've spoken to a number of people, especially women, who are in their 20s, 30s and 40s who have really had trouble in getting that actual diagnosis down on paper.
Actually, it was really simple. What I did is I Googled Asperger's psychologist female and found a lady that had trained under Tony Atwood who was in Melbourne, and I contacted her, and she said, no, it's not a problem, you just bring all this information with you, and we have, it was quite a long diagnosis procedure with two very long meetings, and you take a family member along, so I took my partner along too.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's very hard to do in New Zealand, and it's probably very hard to do if you're not willing to travel. I mean, I travelled all the way to Melbourne for it.
Now, I want to talk to you about your book because obviously we've been talking on the program about education, and I know that this is a passion for you, obviously being an educator yourself, but also your book is primarily focusing on educating children and on the autism spectrum. Can you explain to our listeners about the different models in your latest book, so the medical model, the neurodiversity model, and the lived experience model?
Yeah. One of my jobs is to train teachers how to work with kids on the spectrum. And when I was doing my research, I found out that they only understood the medical model. And so the medical model is where that's where you have your diagnostic criteria from the American Psychological Association or from the International Control Center for Diseases.
Mm-hmm.
And these are the deficits. And if you tick enough deficits, then you're on the autistic spectrum. And the problem is that it actually doesn't capture the autistic experience very well. And so I came to looking at the neurodiversity model, which is actually that we have different brains.
Mm-hmm.
And our brains are so different from people who are not on the spectrum. And I only really realised this when I was doing my research. And around the same time I heard Tony Atwood talk, I was thinking, these teachers don't understand these spectrum kids.
Mm.
I don't understand these teachers, and I get these kids. Why is that? I thought I was brilliant, but it turns out I'm not on the spectrum. And the neurodiversity model, although it's great, and I really like this sort of idea that we have different brains, and so people, for example, with ADHD, their brains also wire slightly differently. But it doesn't capture the personalities and the social experience of being on the spectrum, what it's actually like. And so I talk about the lived experience model, which is that these are experiences that people on the spectrum actually have, and this is what it feels like and is like for us in our daily lives. And when I do that with teachers and talk about exact things that have happened or give them examples from children and young people and adults and myself, it really changes the way that they accept autism. They seem to actually accept that, yes, you are really different, and your difference is valid because of your neurodiversity.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of leaving behind that whole medical model of deficit, 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 because that prevents people seeing potential.
Mm. And the lived model experience?
Sorry, I didn't hear that.
Oh, sorry, the lived model experience, the lived experience model that you talk about?
Yeah.
It says,
experience model, it's really important from two main aspects, the sensory aspect and the communication aspect. So I sound very articulate, and I am very articulate. I'm one of those athletes that never stops speaking. But I can still have miscommunication with people where I have thought they have said something or I have thought they have meant something. And although that happens to all people, it's kind of much more pronounced for those on the spectrum. And I like to get that across, that the level of somebody's verbal ability is no indication of their cognitive ability, and it's also no indication of their understanding.
Mm-hmm.
And that our understanding can fluctuate quite wildly. And for the sensory things, I find it fascinating that I can be in a meeting and I'm hugely distracted by a noise and nobody else in the room can hear the noise. And it's that kind of lived experience thing that people actually don't really know because it's so out of their realm of understanding.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that they don't want to understand, they just have no idea what they're meant to understand.
Mm-hmm. With a lot of the children that you are involved with either teaching or with the families as well, what's the biggest thing when it comes to transitioning them into either primary school or high school that you're finding that is lacking that needs to be addressed?
I think the biggest thing that is lacking is an expectation of progress and success for children on the spectrum and a welcoming attitude. And that sounds crazy because you're thinking, well, you know, understanding must come first. But actually, even with people that understand, if they don't value children as valuable people with things to offer, then it doesn't matter how much the understanding is, they don't teach to that potential.
Mm.
And that was a really sad finding out of my PhD. I was quite devastated by that. But I see it over and over again in my work, and I see how parents will say to me sometimes that the pediatrician will retire. They'll never get a degree, they'll never live independently, and I think, well, why? You know, particularly for people with Asperger's who have known abilities in certain areas, you're thinking, why can't they get a career out of that? Why can't they have a well-paid job? And Silicon Valley is full of people on the spectrum. And I'm concerned that when we transition, because of the way that we, people on the spectrum experience emotion as a sensory input,
mm-hmm.
and when we go into new places, we kind of feel liked or not liked, and sometimes we get it very wrong, but on the whole, we're quite good at that. And kids know when they're not wanted.
Mm-hmm.
Transition into primary school or high school, and if they have a teacher or a school that doesn't want them there, that sees them as a potential problem rather than a potential, it's disastrous.
Mm-hmm. Now, it makes a lot of sense. I mean, we are getting a lot of kids and a lot of families contacting myself and Sarah in regards to transition and how the child isn't being transitioned properly. And then I experienced it firsthand myself with my daughter, where the first 2 weeks was just a nightmare, where they just plonked her in a room full of 70-something kids. And, you know, it was like, oh, no, this isn't working. So we decided, okay, we've done it your way, now let's try it our way. And it was great. We went into an empty classroom with just the teacher and they played some games, and once Audrey was over it, you know, she wanted to finish, we finished. Do you think that teachers need to be listening to parents more about what they know about their kids as opposed to what they've been doing in the schools for years?
Yes, for sure. And so, one of the things I've got in my book is that when a new teacher is meeting a child for the first time, even if they've been in their school, is that they need to bring up the child's special interests. So they need to know what that is first from the parent,
mm-hmm.
and to have a conversation about it, or to show it pictures about it if the child is nonverbal, so that there is automatically that, look, I like something you like, we've got a bond, I'm going to appreciate and value you.
Mm.
When I meet new clients, I always make sure that I know something about them first. I always am very positive and pleased to see them. And I think if we can get that message across, that parents can say, look, you have to actually be enthusiastic about meeting my child, because that's going to make your life really good long term.
Mm.
And what I say to teachers is, if the child doesn't like you because they think you don't like them, they will never do any work for you. And I know this from personal experience, where I refused to go to a physics class for a year, mum and dad. And it's like, when teachers hear it from somebody that's a colleague, they can go, oh, you really are serious. It's not just naughty. It's not just bad behaviour.
Mm.
And it's kind of parents need to advocate about what works, because teachers are still on that autism as bad behaviour mode a lot of the time.
Oh, I know. Believe me, I know. I still get it. Now, you also, you know, you're mentioning your books, because, you know, I really want to plug this book because it's fantastic, but also Hidden Curriculum, because every now and again that pops up. We hear this now and again, you know, with other people too, but you talk about Hidden Curriculum. Can you explain to our listeners what that means?
Yeah, the Hidden Curriculum is all the things that are not be taught, but are the rules and the norms of the school and also of the family and society. So the hidden curriculum would be things like you can swear in the playground, but you don't swear at the teacher.
Mm.
The hidden curriculum in sport is that you don't have the ball to the person who is free, because it's the most talented player. And if people are doing naughty things, you stop when the teacher comes in. And these are all the things that our kids don't know.
Mm.
And spectrum kids are always getting in trouble. And I think about when I changed schools a lot, but I changed schools to one particular school. And I got 500 lines a week. I still have no idea what I was doing wrong. And I'm a teacher now. It's that thing that if we don't teach children how to be successful in the way that their environment operates, if we don't teach them those rules explicitly, how are they going to know? Because our sense of the world is so different.
Mm.
One of the things that I've discovered quite recently is that most people not on the spectrum don't have the same sense of equality that people on the spectrum have. Most of us on the spectrum, children included, tend to think of all living beings as equal.
Mm-hmm.
This way of being. Maybe we're all Buddhists at heart. I don't know. But neurotypical people will say to me, but the teacher's more important. I say to them, but the autistic child doesn't think that. You have to...
Yeah. So now,
in curriculum things.
Sorry, I keep cutting off because we've got this delay from New Zealand to here, and I do want, because we've only got a few minutes left of the show. This is my fault because I couldn't work out this silly calling card. But anyway, understanding and facilitating the achievement of autistic potential is the name of your book, and it's available on Amazon. Just a little bit of a rundown. What can people expect if they get themselves a copy in this book? Has this got everything? Everything? Because I know it does. I'm just wanting you to say it.
This book is also available on Book Depository, so free posting worldwide. It will give you an understanding of what autism is from the inside,
mm-hmm.
from an educational perspective, and how to support your children maximize the in life is to minimise the stress and anxiety for people on the spectrum and to increase their chances at having the most fulfilling life possible.
Yeah, because I do recommend people get a copy of this because it's such invaluable information in there. It really is. I just loved it. So congratulations on that. Are you going to write another one?
Thank you. I will write another one. I'm working with a lot of organisations who have residential care, and they don't know how to work with their adults on the spectrum, and I'm thinking of writing about working with young people and adults as well. And this book, what's so interesting about it is I've given it to some teachers, and it's starting to get around now that teachers are going, wow, this makes me understand everything. Everything's falling in place about this child now.
Mm-hmm.
And that's huge, because if we can change the hearts and minds of teachers, we can change the futures for our children.
I'm going to buy a copy of this for a woman up at La Trobe University who I've been having meetings with, because we've been discussing introducing this into the mainstream teaching degree at La Trobe is a component on teaching children with autism. So I'm going to get them a copy of this book because I think, you know, if they study this one, I think they're going to get it right.
I think so too, and the reason I wrote it was it makes me so mad when I read books about autism, and it says things like people on spectrum have no sympathy and empathy, and I'm like, okay, we don't sound sympathetic, but our empathy is so huge, and we just don't express it the same way, and in those kinds of errors make people misinterpret us, which then makes us misinterpret them, and it all just spirals out of control. So I really wanted accurate information, and I got lots of people to check that I didn't write anything that was inaccurate.
And that's what, you know, happens with a lot of these books. They don't get people to check in. So I'm winding my show down now. So, look, Emma, I'm now you're back. You're in Australia in a couple of weeks, aren't you? I'd love to have the opportunity to talk to you more at length in regards to this.
Yes, and in December, January, I'm moving over to Australia for good. Adelaide is getting my presence there, and I'm looking forward to working with schools and families there and maybe travelling around some and doing workshops and things too.
Oh, Emma, that's so great to hear, because I know Adelaide are desperate. They have such limited resources up there in Adelaide, so I'm so happy to hear that you're going to be there. I know a lot of people up there who would just really, really need your help. So this is great to hear. I'm rapt you're becoming an Aussie.
Never thought I'd do it, but once I got my PhD, I just saw that there was a lot of need over there, and the funding is much better there, and
Well, that's great to hear, and I can't wait. So I'll set it up and we'll do a bit of a chat from Adelaide, and we won't have that New Zealand delay happening.
Great.
Thank you so much for taking the time out. I'm going to pop all the links up that we spoke of. Also, the link to will you be operating your New Zealand business out of Adelaide, or are you starting something up new once you get there?
Basically, I'm going to be working the same company name virtually. It's just got a different ending on it, and you can pop the website link up, because I will be doing Helping Children with Autism-funded services.
Mm-hmm. So that's Healthy Possibilities.
Yeah. And people can contact me on the email then, and I'll just let them know when my email will change and when I'm available to start working. But, yeah.
Oh, look, thank you. And thank you for taking time out. And I'm really grateful. I'm so glad we got to talk. So thank you so much. And as I said, I'll be in contact with you, and we'll have a more extended chat. I think we need to do an hour with you. I think maybe a Q&A session, and get people to send you some questions that they would like to ask of you.
Yeah, that'd be awesome.
I'd love that. We'll do an Ask Dr. Emma session. It'd be awesome. Okay, Emma, thank you so much. You have a great weekend.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye. Yay, we did it. Thank you so much, Brendan. You're a champion. You're an absolute champ. Okay, I've got to go. I'm late. I'm running over. Brendan, what's the theme of your show today?
Jumping songs.
Jumping songs. Jump around.
Jump in my car.
Are you going to do jump around? Jump around, jump up and get down.
I think that's there, actually.
Cool. Awesome. Okay. I am off. Have a lovely week. I hope everybody enjoyed that interview. It did seem a bit rushed, and that's why I really would love to have a nice big extended interview with Emma. I'll pop all those links up onto our site, and have a lovely weekend, everybody. We will speak to you again next week, so take care and stay safe. Okay, bye-bye.
Stay forever who you are. Don't change a thing, because you're perfect. You sway gently in the breeze, in between my dreams. Kinda makes me nervous. Your storm is lightning striking down. Don't it strike me once, would still be worth it. Yeah. Slowly you float while I'm clearly drowning. Regrets.
The voice of your community, 106.7 Phoenix FM.
Friends and lovers I had known.
That's all for this week. Hope you enjoyed the show. Next week we'll be back with more autism news and information. But in the meantime, stay tuned, because coming up next is Brendan O'Brien with his wonderful program, For the Love of Music.